This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Reaction has been coming in from all sides on President Obama's State of the Union address. The reaction from Republican presidential candidates was about as negative as you'd expect. The other side of the aisle was more positive.
Even when you disagree in this country, that is what makes a great democracy.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation with Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Then we'll hear part one of a series of stories on how the Common Core standards are being viewed in the southern states. Spoiler alert, they're not happy. We'll also meet a student who studies and appreciates music she cannot hear. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute finding out if terrorists are using music for evil. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Last week, we highlighted the portions of President Obama's State of the Union address that dealt with education and, well, knowledge. As you might expect, the speech was praised by Democrats and their political allies. The Best of Our Knowledge's Paul Tuttle spoke with one of those allies, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers.
Look, I thought it was vintage Obama. I think the end of that speech, where he really reached out and said that he regretted not being able to change the politics in Washington, and then having a call out about the higher call to service and decency and citizenship and sharing those values. That's what our members do every day. He even mentioned some of our members. I mean, even when you disagree in this country, that is what makes a great democracy. And frankly, people think Washington doesn't work. They think it's bought and sold by the highest, you know, corporate entities and by the wealthy. And frankly, Citizens United, that court case, has helped show that our economy is not balanced for working people and our democracy is not balanced. And I think he tried to say, look, we need to change that. And I thought that was a very powerful moment. I thought his, you know, not going through a laundry list of the things that he was going to try to do, but really think about values on national security, education, and what we need to do to help workers get a better piece of the economic pie. I just thought it was a great values-laden speech.
What's President Obama's legacy as far as education is concerned?
Well, you know, I think it's mixed, but I think I give him a lot of credit that they saw that even their own policies had created over-testing and a fixation on testing instead of a fixation on children. And they did a mea culpa last fall, and they helped us change the law to get rid of No Child Left Behind and to get rid of the testing mania and to move some of this decision-making back to states while still maintaining the federal dollars that have to go to kids when half the kids in our country are in public schools are poor.
Looking at the field of presidential candidates, who do you see there would be the most supportive in your view of public education?
So, look, I am a Democrat, and I really believe that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is fighting to rebalance our economy so that the middle class, there's a revived middle class, and the middle class have a shot again. So, throughout that lens, I unequivocally believe, and our union has endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. She was my senator in New York State. I watched her indefatigability, the fact that she fights every single day for kids, for communities, for families, and she'll bring that fighting spirit to the White House. Plus, she can actually reach across the aisle and try to make the compromises that are necessary to get things done. Experience and an ability to get things done.
Several education issues are likely to make it onto the ballot in the form of referendum questions this year in Massachusetts. Two in particular, proposals to increase the number of charter schools in the state and also to ban Common Core-based education curricula. Has your union taken a position on either of these?
We have taken a bunch of different positions, and the reason I'm just hesitating is that the problem with what's happening in the United States these days is everything has gotten to, you know, a simple yes or no answer. Common Core was supposed to be about how you help kids be prepared for the future that they will see, which is a future of applied knowledge, a future of having to problem solve, having to work in teams, having to critically think. But the implementation of it across the country has been abysmal. and the focus has been on testing whether or not kids have gotten concepts that their teachers have not even been trained upon, as opposed to really trying to think about how you transition to that kind of curriculum. And it's been lockstep, and it's been ridiculously implemented throughout the country, and that's why people hate it so much right now, even though the original purpose was important. And frankly, on charters, a lot of the people who are pushing that in Massachusetts, which has one of the best education systems in the entire country, they're pushing it to supplant public education. Individual charters, there are great individual charters. I happen to run one or help run one in New York City in the South Bronx, where 100% of our kids have graduated from high school. But they were supposed to be incubators. They're not supposed to supplant public schools. We're supposed to be fixing, not closing, public schools and neighborhoods, which should be the center of education. So the people who are pushing it are trying to destabilize Massachusetts education.
You mentioned the Citizens United decision earlier on in the interview. You want to comment on the case the Supreme Court heard regarding the public employee unions in California?
Thank you. This case in the Supreme Court, Friedrichs, is as consequential as Citizens United and as political as Bush v. Gore. Because what's happened is that for 40 years, once there was an ability in the public sector, like the private sector, for individuals to work together to try to get their aspirations fulfilled, whether it's wages and benefits or making the workplaces better so we can serve kids better, for example, in us, or you know, for firefighters so that they have safety equipment. So 40 years ago, there was a decision that said, if you have collective bargaining, because states are different, some states have, some don't, and the union has to be responsible for all people, then there has to be a fair share that people pay so that the union actually has the funding to help all people. And that's been the precedent for 40 years. The original decision was written by an Eisenhower appointee, Justice Potter Stewart. And what you heard in the court, I was in the court, was very political questions to basically take unions out of the equation because, you know, unions represent working people and to keep this imbalance that we have in the economy.
Randy Weingarten has been president of the American Federation of Teachers since 2008. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Paul Tuttle. As long as we're getting political, might as well jump in with both feet. One of the hottest issues debated in state houses across the country in 2015 was Common Core, the national math and language arts standards released in 2010 and adopted by most states. According to the National Conference of State Legislators, more than 730 Common Core bills were introduced across the country last year, including 21 state proposals for repeal. In part one of a three-part series, the Southern Education Desk examines why these public school standards are still so controversial in the South. Today, Cheryl Wheeler Stewart from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, explains the roots of the opposition and the challenges the standards still face.
Mention the phrase Common Core in some circles, and it's equivalent to throwing out fighting words. Some say the national standards control too much of what happens in the classroom. Others balk at the fact that in some states, the standards are linked to federal grants, and some just find them too expensive and confusing.
We're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars, gentlemen, with commissions and standards and all of this stuff, but why can't we just go back to basics? Just teach them how to read.
That's Omeria Scott, a Laurel, Mississippi Democrat, in a spirited debate on Common Core in the state legislature. Mississippi led the South with 31 Common Core bills, including a repeal that was vetoed by the governor. It's not that he doesn't want the repeal, but the bill didn't go far enough to make sure Common Core wasn't used in Mississippi schools. Southern historian Chris Doss isn't surprised by the anti-government sentiment.
You will find it among the Southern region consistently being anti because of a national leader. Also, a general feeling that we don't need that federal government involved in our local situation.
Alabama State School Superintendent Dr. Tommy Bice thinks it's more than just federal involvement stirring opposition.
I think there's this fear the federal government under the current president has a mission to do something sinister through education to change the minds and values of children and their families across the South.
Bice says it's about improving education.
We're talking about mathematics. How do you take the variable X and politicize it? It's a political agenda that is not just unique to Alabama.
So why is Common Core a flashpoint when formal assessments for education have been around for years? UAB Education Dean Debbie Volt says it's about perceptions.
I think there's a fear among some that this could be a national takeover of the schools. People have a concern with the possible or what is perceived to be the loss of autonomy or local control.
She says standards set as part of Common Core provide national consistency in education expectations.
So if I, from Alabama, were to move to California, I could expect that at a minimum, the school system there would be attempting to, at the baseline, meet these commonly accepted notions of what students should know and be able to do.
The Common Core grew out of a bipartisan effort to make sure students graduated ready for college or career. Even some leaders involved in its creation have changed their minds or found themselves in heated debates. The National Council of Chief State School Officers is one of the organizations behind the standards. The group's executive director, Chris Minnick, hears the concerns and says he encourages dialogue.
Common Core standards just say what kids need to learn, not how they're taught it. Some of the legislative battles have been very hard. They've actually been very good to make sure we're having the right conversation.
The most important factor in the debate, Minnick says, is the students and their future.
Whether it's Common Core or any set of standards that a state would have, I think the idea of making sure our kids graduate ready to go on to college or ready to go on to a career training program is really what we were about.
Excited students file into a Birmingham arena for graduation of the Woodlawn High School class of 2015. Valedictorian Trey Hawkins and his classmates have completed the college and career readiness standards. State leaders say Alabama standards are even tougher than the Common Core. Trey says he's ready.
It prepared me more than just my academia, you know, and how I can stand in a classroom setting. It prepared me for a global economy.
Trey, a Gates Scholar, will attend Howard University in Washington, D.C. He plans to become a doctor, return to Birmingham, and open up clinics in low-income neighborhoods. In his commencement address, he used the words of Dr. Seuss to set the stage for what lies ahead.
You have brains in your head. You have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself in any direction you choose. In a simple, nonsensical statement, Seuss has captured the fact that here we are today, graduating, so from now on we will make our own choices and be the controller of our own destinies.
And that's exactly what supporters of Common Core want. For the Southern Education Desk, I'm Cheryl Wheeler-Stewart.
And this report is supported by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Still to come, a student who loves music can't hear a single note. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Louisa Petkir is wrapped up in music. She appreciates all types of music, from classical and hip-hop to rock and jazz. But unlike many other music lovers, the 28-year-old from Hamburg is deaf. From DW Radio, Marcia Adair reports.
Louisa Petkir is a 28-year-old student from Hamburg. She loves music and goes to more concerts than most of her friends. Jazz, classical, hip-hop, it doesn't matter. If there's music playing, she's there. There's one thing, though, that makes her a bit different to the usual 20-something music lover.
I was diagnosed deaf when I was 3, or hard of hearing.
Music has always been important to Louisa.
I always have this memory of a song called Manish Boy by Muddy Waters. I recognize it everywhere I go because we used to listen to it every Sunday morning. I used to say to my mom, please can we listen to it again, just one more time, one time. I felt that I could listen to him and feel the pain in his voice because it's very rich and I could relate to the lyrics.
That's Louisa as voiced by her friend Stella von Randau. Even though Louisa is fluent in German and English, she prefers not to use her voice in public.
I wouldn't say I experience music only physically, because I do hear some things. I just don't know if what I hear is the same as what you hear. It's not only like bam, bam, bam. There's a melody, and sometimes I imagine it in colors. Like when there's a high sound, it's golden or yellow. A deeper sound is blue or indigo. Sometimes you have a very high sound, like a triangle or something, and I can hear that. I couldn't tell you the exact melody, but I think it would be safe to say that I could play it in my head.
Because she wasn't born deaf, Louisa's parents sent her to a hearing school and communicated with audible speech instead of sign language. As she got older and her hearing loss became more profound, Louisa found it increasingly difficult to determine her identity. Was she a speaking person that couldn't hear as well as her peers? A deaf person that couldn't sign very well? Or some combination of the two?
I had a very tough time a few years ago and I felt totally lost. The only thing that helped was to listen to jazz. It helped me calm down. To just sit there and listen. Nobody's asking me to do anything, to communicate, to behave in the way a hearing person would. I would sit there for 2 hours sometimes. It kept me sane, I would say.
Louisa considered getting a cochlear implant, a popular device that uses electricity to stimulate the auditory nerve. In the end, she decided against it. One of the factors was how the implant processes music.
I didn't want to get an implant because I didn't want to have the surgery. And I knew that hearing with an implant is a whole lot different to hearing with a hearing aid or hearing naturally.
Here's a simulation of how music sounds with the implant, created by the University of California at Irvine. See if you can guess the tune. And now here's the same sample as a hearing person might perceive it. Deaf people who like music often like electronica and techno because of the loud volume, the repetition, and the low frequency. All these things make it easier to hear the sound with the body. Louisa loves jazz.
John Coltrane. My friend says it's too emotional to listen to that all the time, but I say no. Maybe it's because I hear it differently. I have a picture in my head of him playing the saxophone with his long fingers and the notes are just rushing out of the saxophone and into the world. I like that image.
What'd you do last night?
Hip-hop is also a favorite.
The new moon rode high in the crown of the metropolis, shining like who on top of this? People were sussling, arguing and bustling. Gangsters are god thumb, hardcore hustling.
There's a song called Respiration by Mos Def and Talib Kweli that starts with a woman speaking Spanish. It says, the city is listening, the city is breathing, just listen. I like the idea of a song about the city you live in and feel content and happy in, but at the same time, you feel like you don't belong and you need to leave.
Louisa learned to play the piano as a child, and a few years ago, collaborated with friends to write hip-hop lyrics. These days, she's interested in sign language poetry, but so far, she writes just for herself.
A friend of mine is always pushing me to sign what I write, but I'm like, not yet. People who start to learn to sign later, like me, I just started 5 years ago, need a lot of time to be fluent enough to do a poem. I think if I want to perform a poem like this, I need to feel deaf, really, really deaf.
Hip-hop, jazz, Mozart, for Louisa, music is everywhere.
Sometimes we're out in a cafe or a bar, and I feel the vibrations in a wooden chair or the sofa, and I say, there's music playing, isn't there? And they say, how do you know, it's so quiet? And I say, come on, it's vibrating all up my legs. When I tell hearing people I feel music, they're saying, oh, you just feel it, but it's not the same. I don't wish they would experience it in the same way, but I wish they would just respect what I feel. I feel it, I'm sure of it. Of course it's different, but for me it's enough.
This is Marcia Adair for Deutsche Welle in Hamburg.
You wouldn't know it from listening to Louisa there, but music can be used for evil. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Music can be a great motivational tool, for good and bad. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Jonathan Pieslak, associate professor of music at the City College of New York, explores how terrorists can use music to further their cause.
The fields of terrorism and political violence often explore what we might call the hard stuff. Tactics, finances, arms acquisition, etc. Softer elements, like the cultural lives of radical groups, have occupied a somewhat peripheral position. But my recent research suggests a stronger focus on aspects of culture. Recent incidents of violent attacks by radicals evidences the strong influence of culture, in particular music. Would Ari Duca have killed U.S. airmen at the Frankfurt airport if not for his iPod containing jihad-themed Islamic songs? Would Wade Page have murdered 6 Sikhs at a temple in Wisconsin if not for his deep involvement in racist skinhead music subculture? Although no one can answer these questions definitively, such cases bring up difficult questions about how those involved in radicalism, and perhaps humanity in general, can be stirred to feel or act under the influence of music. My conclusion is that emotion and social bonding can be pivotal catalysts for music's transformational impact on the radicalization, reinforcement, and motivation for action of violent political activists. Music animates ideology with emotion and can forge social bonds among members. Keep in mind that a group may possess abundant funding, dynamic leadership, and the like, but if they cannot convince a person to risk their lives and kill another human being, then terrorism simply doesn't happen. And music is a fantastic way to stir the passions. So much so that the 14th century Muslim theologian Ibn Taymiyyah, a vital figure in the Salafi theology that groups like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda ascribe to, once wrote, "Music is the alcohol of the soul."
That was Jonathan Pieslak of the City College of New York. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.